H.J. Smith, Reel 6.
The introduction of the Warrant Officer Class 3, I was fortunate in that I got in on the ground floor and I was amongst the first four in the battalion that was promoted.
Did
long before I thought. Beg your pardon?
Did you already have your first class?
Yes, I had indeed.
So there must have been a great queue of people desperate to take exams and you were ahead of
them. That's right. Another interesting facet of Bombay, while I think of it, is the introduction of prohibition. Is that of any use to you?
Yes, when was that?
Just before the war.
Why did that happen?
The Indian government, taking a cue from the Americans for their pussyfoot days, decided it would be a very good idea to have prohibition in India. So they gave notice for a long, long time that on the 1st of August 1939, prohibition would be introduced into India. There's a lot of Indians, you know, Indian races, who abhor alcohol in any form at all and are strict teetotaler. And it was thought it might be a good idea to introduce the whole of India to prohibition. The only people it affected to a large extent, of course, were the military. In all their messes, of course, we had the officers' mess, the sergeants' mess, and in the canteens where alcohol was freely obtainable. This raised a problem because one got to know so many people outside, civilian friends, Europeans, I don't mean Indians, I mean Europeans, and frequently, of course, they were taken back to the mess, or if there was a function, tennis party, dance, and so on and so forth, quite a number of the outside people were invited to them, and that produced a problem. Now, the only place you could get a drink in India, unlike England, where there are lots of public houses, there are no public houses in India, not one. And the only place you could get a drink are in the hotels or in the better class restaurants. The bigger hotels in Bombay, like Green's and the Taj Mahal, and the larger restaurants like Cornaglia's and so on and so forth, one could freely get alcohol as part of one's social makeup. Well, these people, of course, had huge stocks, and they found that these stocks, after the 1st of August 1939, would be useless to them, and that they had about 2 years in which to run down their stocks and get rid of them, because it said that on the 1st of August, anything that remained, customs and excise had the authority to go into their cellars and destroy any alcohol still on the premises. Well, at the beginning, places, hotels and so on and so forth, treated this in a rather light sort of fashion. But as time went on, they realized that the government really meant business on this, so they started to get rid of their stock. So that one would go for a meal at night at Cornaglia's, and towards the end there would be an auction of wines, and one could buy wines of all sorts. You could get all the usual Johnny Walker and Gordon's gin and so on and so forth, as well as all the beers and other wine, table wines, with a great deal of ease. So they began to auction these off, and one could then buy these things to the highest bidder, frequently at half price. And towards the end, as the 1st of August got nearer, almost at giveaway prices, you see. Now, we overcome it in our messes in that it was agreed with the authorities that no civilian would be allowed in the mess to drink. You could bring a civilian in, but he had to be confined to orange squash lime juice. We were not allowed to entertain in our quarters any civilian friends and alcohol there. I would go from here to the mess across the road and stock my wine cupboard from the mess, you see. And that's, we always did that. Everybody did that, you see. And then I could get friends in, and instead of taking them to the mess if I didn't want to, we could have a drink in the house. But that was forbidden. I could still have drink in the house, but I couldn't bring a friend in unless I gave him orange squash and lemonade and so on and so forth.
Presumably people did give drinks to their friends.
Undercover.
Policemen looking in
the window. You had to be very, very careful, mind you, because you had to run the risk of being reported for breaking the law. And when you reached NCO and warrant rank, you didn't lightly disobey orders. Sometimes people were known to do so, but not very, very often. And as the 1st of August drew near, of course, these outside establishments got rid of all their stock as fast as they were able and as far as they were able, so that when the 1st of August came, bingo, prohibited area. But it coincided almost with the outbreak of the war, which took place the 3rd of September, only just a month and 2 days afterwards. And they never really had time to evaluate the system. And the whole thing was dropped. But prohibition was introduced into India on the 1st of August in 1939 and would have stayed but for the outbreak of war.
What other Europeans did you and your wife and family have contact with? I don't mean soldiers.
We made very few civilian friends. I personally had none. We would go to places in Bombay like Breach Candy, which was a holiday resort containing an indoor swimming pool and an outdoor one. You had to be a member to go in, so that membership meant that the riffraff were excluded. And we would talk to people then, and mix, but not to make friends in any way as in the friendship way that we know it as such. Merely, shall we say, casual acquaintances. And a similar thing would take place at a dance, of course. If you met somebody, shall we say, at the swimming pool, and you said, well, we're having a dance on Saturday, would you like to come along? They would come along, but it didn't become a habit. And there were so few civilian organisations outside that there was no reciprocal arrangements that they could make, and therefore it rather limited it. If you gave a party at all on a civilian net, it would have to be at one of the hotels or at Cornaglia's. So that limited it to a very, very large extent. And because of that limitation, very few friendships grew up with the civilian population that I know of.
Did you ever have any social contact with Indians?
In a limited way, yes. But you've got to understand that their standards were very different to ours. Their mode of living was entirely different. The things they ate were completely different to us. So from that point of view, the social link was very, very limited. Very. We were in the messes. I have on occasion attended an Indian function in an Indian regimental mess, where there'd been Indians sat around a table, and things like curry and rice are at, which we also eat, and so on and so forth. But not beyond that, no.
Were places like swimming baths and dance halls segregated so that Indians were not allowed in?
Yes.
Or did it just happen that they didn't go there because they had no contact?
No, the segregation was very marked indeed, very marked. One frequently heard of, for example, in the Bombay Yacht Club, the slightest shade of colour meant that you couldn't go in. And there were some very influential Indians, of course, as black as Nugget's knocker. But because they were black, they couldn't get into the Bombay Yacht Club, and that was always a bone of contention. And you would find in all the larger hotels there was a feeling of segregation, that they just didn't go because they knew very well they would be cold-shouldered. And although there weren't notices up, no blacks allowed, it wasn't necessary to put a notice up because they already knew that it was in for a dig. In our own regiment, we certainly had a colour bar with regard to mixed marriages. It wasn't known as such. You couldn't marry in the army, for example, by taking a bride to a church and getting married. You had to say, "Please, sir, may I get married?" And you had to say who you were marrying. And a publication was made in unit orders that Lance Corporal Henry John Smith notifies his intention to marry Margaret Phyllis Mills at Portsmouth on a particular date. That's the sort of thing that had to be, you see. So that in India, when a man wanted to marry, the colonel wanted to know immediately who he was marrying. It wasn't illegal, it just was not done. And what would happen when Lance Corporal somebody went along to the CO and said he wanted to marry? He had to say who, and it was generally realised long before he got to that stage that he was caught in rather strongly, missed somebody or other. He would be seen, you see, by different people who would spill the beans that she was coloured. And if it was found when he got to the interview stage with the colonel that she was of mixed blood, very quietly he would be transferred somewhere else. Mind you, he wouldn't be told that he couldn't marry. He would be advised not to marry. Be in his own interest not to do so. Why not wait till he'd finished and marry in England? And does his parents know? Would his parents like this? And so on and so forth. In other words, the colonel talked to him like a Dutch uncle and tried to persuade him from marriage. If he was adamant and was going ahead anyhow, then he was very quietly posted away from the station.
How much did you know about the Indian independence movement?
A great deal, because it was one of the things that was promised India if she cooperated wholeheartedly in the Japanese war. We made no bones about it. We said that you wanted India for a long, long time. You help us with the war we've now got on our hands, and at the end of it, we will give you India. That was a well-known fact amongst everybody. Agitators like old Gandhi, he still, of course, went around preaching the gospel, but nevertheless, from the early days of the war, Stafford Cripps said, India will be yours at the end. All they had to do was just wait patiently for the flags to start flying at the end of the war, and India was theirs. But it was a sad reflection on what later took place when India did gain its independence.
Did you ever see Gandhi?
Yes. We had Gandhi in custody at one time. Did the regiment one of these where he went on a hunger strike actually during the time that we had Gandhi, and we, the regiment, had to find a guard for him. In point of fact, I saw him several times. It was a great pity he met the end that he did. He was a very, very true man. Very true indeed. He stuck to his beliefs of peaceful coexistence was his theme throughout life. And as far as he was able, he had a huge following in India. As far as he was able, he always maintained that policy. But at times where he did disagree with authority, of course, he said so in no uncertain terms. And several times, of course, they ended in one of the Gandhi hunger strikes. And it wouldn't have been surprising, of course, if he'd have died during one of them. But he didn't. He lived to, unfortunately, be assassinated shortly after India gained its independence. That cost hundreds of thousands of lives. Indian shooting Indian. Sad. Very sad.
Did you think that British rule was a good thing for India? Or was it just as well for a country to be ruled by its own people?
Well, it certainly made progress under Indian rule. We go back to the East India Company days, of course, that began it all, where there were no roads, railways, bridges, no cultivation hardly of any kind. And built up from there, India became a modern country. Its buildings in places like Delhi, Lucknow, Calcutta, Bombay were some of the finest in the world. Its communication system, mainly Scottish engineers, was again some of the finest in the world, and some of the most difficult, of course, terrain that was successfully bridged and tracked by them. And having got it to a going concern, where it was stood on its feet, to a very large extent. Mind you, it cost millions of pounds to do all this, but nevertheless we did it. The British taxpayer at home helped in this way, of course. And then when it was a going concern, the agitators that existed in India realised what a good thing it was. Instead of them getting in at the beginning and doing all this, they sat back on their hungers and waited for somebody else to do it. And when it was a going concern, they said, this is ours, and began to agitate to take it over. We said at the end of the war, here it is. Gave it to them on a plate. And it's in a sorry state now, is India. Very, very sorry indeed, because they have a policy of what they take out of the land, we put back in, but they don't. They just take out, continue to take out, and replace nothing. And the result is, of course, that the whole of it is going back now to sand and dust, what it was centuries ago, unfortunately. Things like road maintenance, railway maintenance, they just do the bare essentials. And they don't look to tomorrow. They don't say, well, if we don't do it now, tomorrow it'll be worse and will cost twice as much. So therefore we'll do it now. The policy is we'll just do enough to keep it going. Tomorrow comes, the damage is greater. And so, and that's roughly what's happened throughout the whole of India today.
Did you feel it was natural to be in India, natural for Britain to be in India, or were you always an outsider the whole time?
No, the Indians, on the whole, liked us being there. They appreciated what we were doing for them. They were very, very grateful for opening up the country that we did to the extent that we did. And it was only the agitators that fomented trouble that caused it all, you know, really. On the whole, I would say that perhaps on balance, 50-50 wanted us to stay and appreciated what we were doing. The other half said, no, you get out.
After the outbreak of war, you had to get your family back to England, which could have been quite dangerous. In fact, from what you've said, it was lucky. The British civilians went on a different ship, I think, than they were intended to.
Well, they didn't come home with us, you see. Suddenly there was a situation arose, shall we say, which necessitated lots more troops being required at a given place. So rather hurriedly and almost overnight, 7 regular battalions, of which we were one, were hurriedly put on ships and left Bombay. We think we were destined for France, but during the voyage home, the fall of France took place. We eventually arrived in Liverpool. Our families, of course, there was a war on. The government wasn't bothered a great deal about families. They wanted to get on with the war, and women and children would be a nuisance and in the way. So the families were left in India. And it was after we got home, and we'd been home about 6 months, that our families joined us. Soldiers' families in India that remained in India were farmed out to different places. Some went to South Africa. Some went as far afield as Australia. But for some reason that was decided at the time, our families of the 7 regular battalions that all left at the one time found themselves back in England. And shall I tell you about them, Rach? They had rather an alarming experience in that when the ship left Bombay, it was grossly overcrowded. And because of that, the captain of the ship said, this isn't on. There's far too many people on the ship and you must take them off. They persuaded him to sail under the promise that by the time the ship got to Durban or Cape Town, they would transship onto another vessel, a part of the complement. And that was the agreement. Some of our families were due to be transshipped at Cape Town onto the Empress of Britain. The Empress of Britain was a large vessel on the Canada-Liverpool run, you may know, Cunard. And that was working to a tight schedule, and it was only half full. But because of its commitments, it had to leave Cape Town before the arrival of the ship on which the families were. So the Empress of Britain virtually steamed out of Cape Town at the time they steamed in. So they stayed on the ship that they were on, the Orcades. I'm not sure if any transshipment did take place on Orcades, but however, the Empress of Britain sailed virtually half empty ahead of them. And ran into trouble. It was eventually sunk ahead of them. Got a torpedo, I believe. And behind them was a convoy of vessels being escorted by an armed merchantman named as the Jervis Bey, which... just one vessel looking after a huge convoy of ships, and it never stood a chance. It met up with one of these German pocket battleships that were roaming the Atlantic at the time, and Jervis Bey did what it could. It ordered the convoy to scatter and do what it could to look after itself, whilst it, the Jervis Bey, with what guns it had, what few guns it had, fired madly at the pocket battleship, steaming towards it the whole of the time, hoping to put it out of action. And it was just a sitting duck. The Jervis Bey just simply got blown out of the water, and eventually the captain of it was awarded a posthumous VC. There were no survivors. And of the convoy, of course, the merchantmen were just simply picked off one at a time, and a goodly number of them just simply were sunk. So the families had that worrying time. They didn't know anything about this, of course, except that wreckage was seen floating and so on and so forth. They were very angry about missing the Empress of Britain, but thankful at the end, of course, that they had, and learned later of the Jervis Bey convoy long afterwards. And I went went to Liverpool first of all to meet the ship as a representative of the unit to look after the welfare of. We had about 50 families on it, I suppose, with perhaps about 100 children, varying ages. Liverpool knew nothing at all about it. embarkation staff eventually at the end of a week. What we didn't know then at the time was that the Orcades, the ship that they were on, in order to dodge all this trouble, was steaming further and further away from the coast of England, going towards Canada, and almost lapping the shores of Canada before they were able to turn around and make their way home. All this took extra time, of course. So Liverpool said, we don't know anything at all about this thing, and eventually embarkation staff there said it's going to dock at Glasgow. So Glasgow bound we were with embarkation staff. Glasgow said no, they never knew anything at all about the ship. And eventually we married up at Gourock, up on the west coast of Scotland, a little harbour on its own, and that's where Orcades eventually landed. Couldn't get in, it's a harbour. They had to transship on lighters over onto the quay. And when I got to know this, I persuaded the people on a lighter that were going out to Orcades to allow me to go with them. They didn't want to do it, but nevertheless I said my wife and children are on this ship and I'm very anxious about them. And I went out and I was able to go aboard Orcades and say, welcome home. India heard nothing hardly. Have you switched on? India heard nothing hardly of the European war. And Bombay, within a few days of the outbreak of war, got its first shock with gunfire, in that it was decided to challenge all ships entering Bombay Harbour. And Bombay has a little tiny island in the middle of the water called Middle Ground, which is manned by artillery, our own Royal Artillery, I mean, with siege guns and so on and so forth, all, like Singapore, facing out to sea. And out on Calabar Point itself is a signal station where ships approaching the Indian coast can be seen for miles. So that when a ship got within range of Calabar Point, it was signaled, asking for certain information, what ship, whither bound, what cargo, something of that kind. Usually that information was forthcoming immediately by lamp. But about, I would think about a fortnight after the outbreak of war, a report was received very early one Monday morning in Bombay that there was a ship approaching, and it looked to be of a warlike character, which refused to answer signals, said Calabar Point. What should they do? Repeat the signals. And these signals were repeated for quite a while. Gradually the ship got nearer and nearer and nearer. So Middle Ground, the people with the guns, were alerted on this. And there came a time when it passed the range of Calabar Point and was picked up then by Middle Ground, who immediately signaled, stop or I fire. No reply. The ship gradually steamed in, steamed in. Middle Ground, of course, not wanting to take the responsibility, in touch with port control. What shall we do? Ship continues to approach, will not answer challenge, will not stop. And after a lot of argy-bargies, signals being passed to and from, port authorities said, open fire. So Middle Ground, and of course the population of Bombay never knew anything at all about this. We knew it, we were stood by the military. Open fire, and Middle Ground did, and there was a tremendous explosion of a 5.2 or some other huge caliber gun suddenly belching out a shell, fired straight over the bows of this approaching vessel. By now it was known and could be seen to be a warship. And that immediately produced results from the ship itself. It said, Australian Navy. It was HMS Australia, one of their best ships. Afterwards, they were asked why they didn't answer any of the signals or accept the challenge and so on and so forth. And they said they didn't know who was producing this sort of nonsense. How did they know that Bombay was on our side?